Hello, all you giddy goblins and inglorious imps. It's Ding Dong Darkness time, and I'm Allison Dixon, here to bring you a different kind of episode where we not only give shouts out to some of our most dedicated listeners, but also shed some light on some unresolved mysteries. We're about keeping things straightforward around here, so we're calling it 10 Cities, 10 Mysteries, and big props to the man who actually came up with the concept, my best good buddy and co-host of the 80s High podcast, Chris Armstrong, who is actually here with me today, again, in my dining room.
In studio.
Yes.
So excited to come back. And this is a little love letter to your listeners. And I was like, hey, we love talking about mysteries. What if we highlighted a couple? And I was like, what if we did it based on listeners?
Yeah.
Like, who's out there tuning in week by week, month by month?
Yeah.
And I don't know, maybe you'll learn a little something about the town you grew up in, live in, all that sort of good stuff. And who knows, maybe this could be like a fun regular thing to do.
Yeah, we thought it would be really cool after looking at how the year-end statistics lined up and seeing how the popular cities have kind of grown and changed in terms of the listenership. When I started doing this, I mean, it was only Dayton, Ohio. Well, not only, but it was the biggest by far because most of my friends and family live out here. But then it really started to take off as the show grew, and it went to some surprising places that I didn't expect. So,
yeah.
and I should say too, the lineup may have adjusted since then, but you know, since we looked at these, back in mid-December, but we also figured out that, you know, that would make this a good reason to do this as a recurring thing, because those locales can change and, you know, new cities will pop up in the top 10. And we also figure, you know, if anybody out there want us to cover a specific locale, you know, we might just add it to the list, especially if it gets some popularity. So, or if enough of you reach out and say,
That's right.
We want you to talk about Bismarck, South Dakota, or North Dakota, or wherever Bismarck is the capital of.
Hey, listen, every town has mysteries. Every
yes.
place has cool secrets and unknown things that that haunt and delight.
Absolutely. And some of the cities that we'll be talking about, you know, you'll hear and you'll automatically think of, you know, the mystery that defines it. And we're looking to sometimes subvert that, and sometimes we're going to lean into it.
Yeah.
That's kind of how we'll keep the suspense going. Also, this is going to be something a little like Unsolved Mysteries, where it's a little bit of murder, little bit of maybe missing people, little bit of weird, possibly paranormal, possibly supernatural. And the thing is, too, Chris and I have not really compared notes at all. I have no idea what he's doing. He has no idea what I'm doing. So
we want the mysteries, too. Like, not just we want them for you, the listeners. But I was like, you know, or maybe you even said it early on, like, let's not tell each other what we're doing. I was like, well, that's a great idea, because I want to be surprised. And I know Allison well. We've known each other for many years. But I couldn't with any certainty guess what some of these are going to be.
Right.
And you've given me little glimmers, and then she pulled a great one. It won't be until the part two episode, but she's like, I had to make a last minute switch, and you won't believe what happens next.
Exactly. I clickbaited him a little bit, whatever the verbal version of that is.
The mystery I cover is going to stop your heart cold. And I was like, I got to know.
Yeah. And that's the thing. We realized, you know, sometimes Chris and I do have a tendency to bite off a little more than we can chew. So covering 10 cities in one episode is a little much to ask.
Yeah.
This would be a long episode. So
we're not into the whole, you know, brevity thing here.
No, not at all. So we're going to start in reverse order and then we're going to do five, and then we'll do the remaining five. You could tune in next week for that. Also, we're eventually going to also do the countries, 10 countries, 10 mysteries, because we liked the data that we saw for the top 10 countries that tune into this show. Hell, I'm happy that there are 10 countries that tune into this show. So grateful to all of you out there.
And one of them isn't the United States. I mean, it was, but obviously,
yeah.
you know, we took that off the list, but there were, 11 countries in total.
That is true. We did have a full 11 that aren't the US. Yeah, there were more, but yeah, you know, we figure top 10s are always nice. But yeah, we're not going to cover the US because we figured this series with the cities is going to cover the United States quite well.
Yeah.
So the number 10, are we ready to dive right in?
I don't want to delay anymore because I got to know what these mysteries are.
Okay. All right, my friend. Well, number 10 is one of my favorites. It is often called the Big Peach, also referred to as the New York of the South. It would be Atlanta, Georgia.
Also known as Hotlanta.
Hotlanta.
Which if you're from Atlanta, you love it when people call
it that. Of course. Yeah. Yeah. Always reaching out, you know. I have not spent a lot of time directly in Atlanta, but I have family in Georgia, have driven through Georgia a lot, and then South Carolina. I have family all down through there. So I have a little soft spot for it. But I will say that the mystery that I have picked today, Atlanta has a lot of kind of famous cases, the more famous true crime being the Atlanta child murders. Mm-hmm. That took place back in the 80s, but I'm not covering that today because that's a big case. It deserves its own thing. And some might say it's already solved. I don't know that I agree with that, but some might say it's already solved. This one is a little weirder than that. So this took place back in 1987. The address it's a house. Located at 1114 Fountain Drive. And yeah, I'm giving an address because it's in every article that I've ever covered on this. And I think it's actually kind of a weird landmark now.
Huh.
And it was built in 1945. It is a brick house with 3 bedrooms, a very standard home. There are 7 rooms total in that house. And in September of 1987, for some inexplicable reason, the house began to bleed.
Say again?
The house began to bleed.
Okay. I'm picturing bodies in the walls that are slowly draining of their... What is going on now?
Okay,
what
so...
What the heck?
The home was inhabited by a couple, William and Minnie Wilson. They were in their late 70s. And Minnie was stepping out of the bath one night when she noticed blood stains on the bathroom floor. And she thought maybe she'd cut herself or something like that. And the husband, you know, he's had some medical issues and stuff too. And so Minnie spent most of her time taking care of him. And so she also thought maybe her husband, because her husband undergoes dialysis on a regular basis. So she thought maybe it could have been something like that. And this was around 11:30 at night. Not only were there bloodstains on the floor, she found that there were parts between the tiles where it was spraying through like a little sprinkler, as she described it. And upon further investigation, they found that not only was this red blood-looking substance coming through there, it was in the hallway. It was in the kitchen, in the living room, the bedrooms, the basement, the house's crawl space, in the attic. It was on the floors, it was in the walls, and it looked like blood, and they couldn't figure out where it was coming from. I sound like I'm telling a ghost story around a campfire right now.
This seems unreal. This right. Definitely, yeah, you're around a campfire. Like, are they sure it's blood?
Okay. We will get to that.
Okay.
All right. So the couple called 911 and they dispatched some EMTs to
I'm
the
sorry,
house.
How do you even have that phone call?
Oh, I know.
My house is bleeding. I'm sorry, you're what? a mouse? Should you call a veterinarian? No, the house. Sorry, who?
Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
My
house
home
is bleeding.
Yeah. Like, that is a crank call. The cops come out. And,
yeah. You know, it's amazing that they got anyone, right?
Wow.
And so, you know, of course, they checked and made sure neither of them was injured and that the blood wasn't coming from them. This was reported in the Associated Press. This was big news. Okay. And nobody else was there. That was the thing. They couldn't find a source for the blood. There was no body in the nobody else in the house. They had no explanation for how it got there. They locked their doors. They had a security alarm. The house was clean. I mean, it was really nothing had tripped the alarm. It was really just what the hell, right? So they take some samples of this blood. And it comes back, and it was blood. It was human blood.
Is it the same type of blood?
It was not.
Oh my God.
It was type O. Okay. Both Winnie and William were type A.
But all the blood was O. They
all didn't the find, blood like, is O.
A splash of B over here and a
right.
Okay. All
right. Right.
Wow.
And of course, the reports didn't specify if it was O negative or positive, but it doesn't matter because it's not theirs. It was not type A blood. It was type O blood. So
the house is a universal donor.
Pretty which, thank God, right? I mean, is there any way I can like collect this blood and donate it? But yeah, the police were like, what the hell is going on? Because the problem was there was no evidence of crime that was taking place. They couldn't figure out where it was coming from. They couldn't find, obviously, a body. There are detectives being quoted that were there. And they were on the team, that they were there that night. And they were like, they've never seen anything like this before. There wasn't like a hose, you know.
Right.
Like, because if this was like a prank or something, you would find like bags of blood or or you know, something like that, like,
and it's
somebody
not coming
rigged
from
the house.
A single source. It's
right.
not coming out of like a drain where it somehow got backed up from
this is like something
a morgue down the street
out of It, you know. This is very a Pennywise
quite literally
moment.
A
spokesperson for the police told the Associated Press it's not going to be a, you know, the house that bleeds kind of case, because houses don't bleed. There was no consensus though among the people working the investigation, because they were like, is it a hoax, is it a homicide? But the officers weren't assuming it was a hoax, because you find human blood in a house, you know, you're thinking it's got to come from a person.
Right.
Where the hell does blood just come from?
Right.
Although you do make a good point that if a house is going to have a blood type, type O is pretty handy, you know. But they had no leads at all. And then time went on. And see, here's where it gets interesting. Well, it was already interesting in case it wasn't interesting.
I was pretty bored up to this point. I was not intrigued. So
okay.
Please.
Oh, yeah. The house that bleeds. Come on. Move on.
That old trope.
But I truly do feel like the absence of evidence of a hoax is kind of even creepier in a way. Because like I said, you know, you don't just rig something like this up and not have evidence of that.
Sure.
And it made it even into the New York Times. But of course, how could it be a murder without a body around? And why is it coming out of all these places? And why is it the same blood? It's a lot of blood.
Right.
So anyway, there was a huge media circus, and the Winstons became very uncomfortable about it. They didn't like all the attention that they were getting. And they were quoted frequently in the news. In the article I'm reading from here, expressing their frustration with the constant phone calls and looky-loos, which
looky
I was
looky-loos, man.
Yeah, them looky-loos stalking their home, because people were like coming down and, you know, wanting to get in and everything. And eventually, Winnie, she was like, I still don't know where the blood came from, and I'm tired of all these people asking me all these questions. If anybody comes here today, I'm not going to open my door. And then it was like, bam, she locked up tight. They were not talking about this ever again.
Do we know if the blood was still flowing or had it stopped?
You know, everything that I had read on this was like, she's saying, because she was screaming from the windows when people were coming over, saying, because there was all these paranormal investigators trying to show up too, that there's no blood in the house. Now get away from here. Leave us alone. Like, okay. They immediately flipped the switch. Like, they first were like calling, you know, saying like, what the hell is this? And then, you know, all of a sudden they're like, get out of here. I don't want the attention.
Right.
So I guess they just didn't realize. I think they figured maybe if they see blood, the cops will figure it out. But then it became this big thing, this big deal. Yeah. And this was, again, 1987. So at this time, you and I are just little kids, you know, this wouldn't have been on our radars really. And so there was like, all these different parapsychologists that turned up. William George Raleigh Jr., he was a parapsychologist, and he wrote a book in 1972 called Poltergeist, which is not connected to the movie in any way. But he had been trying to get permission to enter that house for years. He was really harassing them, though. He was being a jerk. But when you hear about a house that's bleeding and you happen to be a parapsychologist or paranormal investigator, that's like the Moby Dick, you know.
Yeah, it's a once in a lifetime thing. You're like, I'm never going to have this come up twice.
Yes.
I have to find out what's going on.
So about 6 weeks go by and the detectives are still, you know, talking to the media and saying they haven't stopped looking because they know houses don't bleed, but they just haven't determined that a crime is committed. And so it's just a weird little gray area. And soon they just kind of gave up. Like there was no other evidence that came out that a crime had been committed and the case is still marked unsolved. And as far as theories go, there were two, although neither of them look particularly great. So they had grown children and there was the possibility that there were like some problems within the family and that the kids had hoaxed them into believing this in order to claim them mentally incompetent to get hold of their money.
Oh, wow.
So to kind of get like a power of attorney and all that. And in fact, one of the children worked in a hospital.
Okay.
So there is, to me, like for as far as theories go, that's some good money there. But if there's blood oozing out of something or spraying out of something, as she described, again, that requires a mechanism of some kind. You know, I'm just thinking of like Hollywood and, you know, all the little tricks and of the trade that you would use. And they didn't, there was no indication that they found anything like that because they weren't able to prove it was a hoax.
Yeah, it's also one of those things now where you have to wonder, was somebody misquoted? Did they say something that was taken a different way or was something exaggerated in terms of, you know, the spraying aspect of it? Was it, you know what I mean? Like,
right.
We could have any number of unreliable narrators. From the person reporting it to the person who's reporting on it.
And the other theory is kind of similar. They were saying, well, maybe Winston, the husband, did it because he, being a dialysis patient, might have access. But dialysis patients don't have access to human blood and it wouldn't be type O blood. It would be his own blood type. So even if he was on a dialysis machine in his own home and you know, he had done something, because a dialysis machine, for those who don't know, will recycle your blood through this machine to clean it out because your kidneys are failing.
Yeah.
So there would be blood and lines, you know, going in and out and cleaning your blood. But I mean, that wouldn't explain the existence of type O blood in this house.
Yeah.
That leaves a lot of people just, you know, they're going down the paranormal route. In fact, I'm not going to lay any claim to that at all, but Mrs. Winston, at some point, she started to say it wasn't blood, that it was rust and mud and not blood, even though in fact it was. In fact, she even tried to say on another occasion that it was red dye that had leached out from a rug or leaky water from leaky pipes, but that never was proven either.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it has been 22 years. And in fact, this is pretty astonishing. Willie, the husband, he died only a couple of years after this incident. Minnie, however, she lived until 104. She passed away in 2015.
Wow.
And no other incidents have been reported at that house since. But it is such an interesting mystery that I was like, man, a bleeding house? That seems like a good place to start.
Yeah, it feels like one of those stories that there's probably a very reasonable explanation.
Yeah.
But the lore has been built up so much and the media frenzy and the speculation.
Yes.
That, you know, I would love to know what the actual result is. I don't personally think there's anything supernatural or crazy going on. I mean, there might be a really bizarre thing that people hadn't thought about that just happened to happen. I'd love to know what it is.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's wild.
And the media storm, I guess, that was created around it too. I mean, this was making the national news. Mm-hmm. You think about the AP and the New York Times talking about this thing. So I'd love to know if you live in Atlanta or you're more familiar with this incident, and you have some additional information, feel free to reach out to me because I would love to know more about this house.
Or maybe you're the grandchild of one of the parents who perpetuated the hoax.
Yeah.
Grandma and grandpa.
I know. And do they have type O blood?
Come do a let's do a tell all. No.
But thank you, Atlanta, for being on the top 10. Great town. So now, the way that we ordered these and of course the order that it falls in and the way Chris and I sort of divided the cities between ourselves ultimately means that I am also doing the next city on the list.
So. And this is the one that was so puzzling, and we're hoping you as listeners can help us figure out this mystery. This mystery is embedded in the story you're going to tell. So the mystery is what this location is and why it's in our top 10.
Exactly. It is in a town called Sun City Center, Florida. And I had never heard of it before. So when I went and did my research, I learned that it's basically its own self-contained retirement community, but it has grocery stores, banks, leisure attractions. It is like a town within the town, but it's for people 55 and over, I believe.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it's a one person hanging out down there listening to the show, or if there's like a whole enclave of ding dongs down there just, you know, hanging out and listening week by week. But either way, I appreciate you. And I also realize that there isn't much by way of actual murder, mayhem, and otherwise going on in your little retirement community. Or if there is, please reach out and let me know. But I decided, though, for the sake of whatever, I would do a bend the rule just a tad and go to the much more adjacent city of Tampa Bay, because Sun City Center is a little more inland in terms of land. It's more kind of heading toward, you know, central Florida, but it's very adjacent to Tampa. So, and on that side of Florida, by the way, I've actually never been to Florida.
Oh, wow.
I never set foot in Florida. That is an interesting bit of trivia that I'm in Ohio and I've never been to Florida, because that's where a lot of people from here like to flock down there.
That's the go-to spot.
Yeah.
That's
and you have family down there. So Chris has spent a good bit of time in Florida. So,
And actually they're near the Tampa Bay area. Yeah. So it's not too far from Sun City Center. I don't know if you said it. If you're from Sun City Center and you can explain why this is like the number one podcast there, I'm assuming.
That'd be awesome.
Thank you for listening. We'd love to know more about, like, is there like a book club or a podcast club, or is there like something that, I mean, Atlanta makes sense. It's a big metropolitan area. This is like, this is a small self-contained community. So we were both really puzzled as to how it made the list, and we got to know. So help us solve that mystery.
Yes. If you are listening, please reach out.
So what do you got from the
Tampa Bay? This one is definitely, this one switches tracks entirely. I don't have a bleeding house or a puking car.
Did you sneak down into St. Pete, or did you keep it Tampa proper?
I kept it pretty. It's Tampa proper. Okay. I was tempted to head down St. Pete. There were a few different ones I could have chosen, because one of the most famous cases from the area is a case of spontaneous human combustion. Mary Reeser. And that's a very interesting one. I might just save that for a Ding Dong Ditch episode, because that subject is very fascinating to me. But this one is actually a cold case, a missing person cold case. But it takes some odd twists and turns that I thought made it unique enough to bring up here. And as I was researching it, I found a really great write-up on Reddit by user Mile High Mystery, and did a fantastic job kind of laying out the timeline and everything. So big shout out to Mile High Mystery for doing that for us. And the case involves a woman named Lucinda Hewells. And there might be some podcasts out there on her. We're going to do kind of a Reader's Digest condensed version of all these. And that's the thing I meant to mention is, you know, everything we're talking about today, there's a lot of great material out there. And we're going to try to like direct you to sources or other content where we can. And it'll be in the show notes as well. So Lucinda Hewells, this case takes place back in the 80s, 1984. But in 1981, well, let me back up a little bit further. Lucinda Harris was born on April 6th, 1967. She was the oldest of three children. And in 1981, which puts her at a very young age here, she found out she was pregnant. So that would put her around, what, about 14 years of age. And so on April 3rd, 1982, 3 days before her 15th birthday, she married the father of the unborn child, the 19-year-old Larry Hewells. And the newlyweds lived in Tampa, Florida, where they both grew up. And their son was born in November. And in February of 1984, they had another child named Deanna. And even though she was a young mom, she was also very involved in parenting. But because she was a young mom, you know, you're still kind of sowing those young oats. I mean, I wasn't a mom that young, but as someone who became a mother at the age of 21, even that involved fighting and the push and pull of youth with responsibility.
For sure. Yeah.
And so she would go out and, you know, do some partying, you know, in the night hours, you know, once the chores were done, the kids were in bed, she'd go out and go down to the local tavern with some friends and do a little partying around. But it didn't seem like something that her husband had any real problem with. And she was also getting a part-time job that she would do when her husband came home from work. And they only had one car between them. So she would drive him to work and yada, yada. So again, interesting situation. And here's where it also gets interesting. She actually went missing on my birthday, October 26th of 1984. That evening, she told her husband she was going to do the family's laundry at the nearby laundromat. It's the last time her family saw her. At some point, she folds the laundry, puts the laundry baskets in the backseat of her car. And then, and this is around like 9 p.m., she starts walking back to her apartment building. Because the car was like there. Apparently the car was like adjacent to the apartment and the laundromat and the bar that she ended up going to with a friend. The bar was called the Char Pow Lounge. And the interesting thing about this place, though, is that it has some well-known organized crime ties.
Okay.
Was actually featured in the movie Goodfellas.
Oh.
Which I thought was an interesting little side note there. Huh. And so she and a couple of her friends, one named Nika and the other one named Linda, they went and decided, hey, we're going to go and have a couple drinks, hang out at the bar. This is around 9:30. And so the three women left the apartment, walked down to the lounge. And apparently this is where the timeline gets a little tricky because, of course, when you're at a bar with your friends, sometimes you're at the bar drinking. There might be someone over there playing pool. There might be someone over there talking to some friends. You kind of split up.
Yeah.
Sometimes you get a little separated from one another. And so Linda looks over and sees Lucinda talking to a guy named Larry Moore. And apparently he had offered her a job with his company. She was supposed to start the job a few days later. And so that was where she was getting her part-time job from. So this was like one of the last people that she saw Lucinda talking to. And then this night starts getting very late. And by the way, Moore, Larry Douglas Moore, the guy, he left the tavern alone at 11 p.m., never saw her again. Sometime between midnight and 1 a.m. on Saturday, October 27th, her friend Linda left the Char Pow Lounge with another friend. As they walked out, Linda spotted Lucinda smoking in the parking lot with several other people. They were all pretty intoxicated by this point, but she heard Lucinda's laughter. Linda walks up to her and asks if Lucinda wants to come home. Lucinda said, no, you know, I'm still having fun. You go on ahead. So Linda leaves. And again, that was the last time Linda saw her. But Linda comes down the next day and sees that Lucinda's car is still parked where it was with the laundry in the back where she left the car. Because apparently it's all within walking distance. The car was there. And so she goes back and tells Lucinda's husband. And they found the car. And he comes down. They find the car unlocked. The folded laundry still in the back seat. Her belongings, including the car keys, were nowhere to be found. There was no sign of her. Larry starts freaking out. And there's so many L's. I'm just noticing that so many of these cases are so many names that start with the same letter and I get a little mixed up. You true crime podcasters out there, just hats off to you.
Yeah.
Keeping it all together, man. It's tough. Anyway, so Larry got a little worried because even though that she liked to go out and party, she was always good at getting home early enough and getting up with the kids in the morning and stuff like that. So it was not like her to not contact or not be home.
Right.
So Larry and Lucinda's mother, Helen, they began driving around the lounge and the areas surrounding, seeing what they could find. And of course they couldn't find her at any of her other normal hangouts. And so then they called the cops. And so Larry tried to start getting the media involved just to put some notice out there. And the media was being very reticent. In fact, when he tried to get the newspaper to put something out, they were asking him to pay $500 advertising fee.
What? Wow.
Pretty terrible.
Wow.
Lucinda's mother said that the cops didn't really take it very seriously because, you know, they figured she was married, was last seen at a tavern. They just didn't jump on it.
Right.
Again, it's kind of interesting to see the cases that, you know, ignite that fire and the ones that don't. I don't know if it's because, you know, they didn't have a lot of money and, you know, she's a young mom and, you know, maybe they just kind of made assumptions like, oh, of course, she's just out and about, you know, being promiscuous and, you know.
Well, and being the mid-80s, I think, you know, you don't have quite the attention on stuff like this as you
right.
you do nowadays.
Absolutely.
And still, some departments will not take it seriously.
Agreed. Yeah, it's unfortunate. And so they took to just putting flyers all over town. She would put them on truck stop bulletin boards and, you know, things like that. And so, and there was other things that they were looking forward to. She was planning birthday party for the youngest son. They were getting ready for Halloween. I mean, there was all these things. They knew she wouldn't run away. And of course, 2 weeks after she disappears, their son celebrated his second birthday without his mother there. And it's just, it's awful. So, in November, so this was a few weeks later after the disappearance, they actually found in the Busch Garden Zoo campground in North Tampa, which was a couple miles from the lounge, in a men's room bathroom stall, they found her purse containing her ID, marriage certificate, which was not uncommon to carry with you, especially back in those days, because if you, and especially if she was getting ready to start a new job and her ID is different from her name, I've had to have my marriage certificate on hand for things. So there were some people that pointed out, why would she have her marriage certificate if she wasn't planning to run away?
Right.
And it's like, no, sometimes you need to have it.
Yeah.
And there were some other personal belongings. They, never found the keys to the car. And there was, again, there was still money in the purse. So after the purse was recovered, that's when the cops finally started to pay attention to the case and investigating. And the police interviewed the friends that were there with her at the bar. Nika, Linda, and Linda's ex-husband, Sam, were all ruled out as suspects. Now, again, this is turning into your classic missing persons case, right? Let's jump forward into the 90s. This is around the early 90s. And apparently the cops began to wonder if Lucinda had been a victim of a serial killer in the area known as the classified ad rapist. Oh. Bobby Joe Long was his name. And he lived in Tampa at the time that Lucinda disappeared. And he would often target young women at bars and clubs. And apparently the Char Pow Lounge was in his praying grounds. But law enforcement dug into that pretty deep. And they didn't come to any conclusion. And Long was actually executed in 2019. And he denied it having anything to do with Lucinda Huell's disappearance. So that's kind of, well, it's literally a dead end lead at that point. But here is where it really gets weird.
Okay.
In 2015, Deanna, who is Larry and Lucinda's daughter, contacted Fox 13 News in Tampa about a phone call that she answered in 1992 when she was 8 years old. And there was a woman on the other end who said that she was her mother.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Who Lucinda would be 25 by that point. And she told Larry that got Larry on the phone that she ran away and left her family because she was stressed out from the pressures of being a young mom. And then said that she was living in a mobile home and working as a waitress. So the family, by this point, they're bewildered, but they're also ecstatic because at this point, they're thinking she's long dead.
Right.
And so they invite her to come on, get your ass home, come on down, you know, and they wanted answers. And so Lucinda's younger sister, Katrina, said the event was like just really, you know, was exciting, but terrifying. Like they were all just very emotional. And so when the woman arrived in the summer of 92, the family was immediately suspicious. They were like, something was off about her because
she's pretending to be Lucinda.
It seemed like it because there were things like she had an explanation for every inconsistency. And also there was a gap between Lucinda's front teeth that was no longer there because she said she had braces.
Yeah.
And then she said, oh, there's these other differences that like her jaw's a different shape. Oh, I had reconstructive surgery after a car accident. Things like that to explain some of the differences in appearance. And even though the woman looked a good bit like her, despite that, Lucinda's siblings were thinking this was definitely an imposter. And in fact, yes, that was true. This woman is a woman from Arkansas named Amanda Michelle Dennis. And Amanda did, in fact, run away from her family. And they were wondering where the hell she was. Wow. And so who the hell is Amanda and where is Lucinda? And to this day, no one knows why. And in fact, there's no connection between these women at all that they've ever been able to find. Very little information, they say, and they don't know much about her life before or after impersonating Lucinda Hewells. She was just a runaway teenager is all they could really guess. But apparently they were able to find out that in 1990, Amanda met an 18-year-old named Danny Fletcher while she was waitressing in Arkansas. And within months of meeting, the two were married in October of 1990. And when Danny and Amanda got married in a small courthouse ceremony, Amanda provided her voter registration ID instead of a birth certificate, which she claimed is no longer in her possession. She didn't have any personal documents or records of any kind, no photographs of her or her family, no family heirlooms, no nothing. And anytime someone would try to ask about her family or wanting to take her picture, she'd get really nervous. So this person is a total enigma. Mm. And so in the summer of 90, when she, under the guise of Lucinda, she made the trip to Florida and she told them about hitchhiking from the Charpaw Lounge to Memphis before relocating to Arkansas. But they would go through photo albums and stuff, and Amanda would have like no real knowledge about anybody that they were looking at and all this stuff. So anyway, Amanda got very defensive when confronted, and then the sheriff shows up and starts asking questions and demanding like she take a blood test. And of course she did.
Right.
And, you know, it found that it wasn't her. And Amanda Dennis has never provided a reason for why she impersonated or how she could have even, maybe she heard about her in the media or something like that.
I would have to think that, yeah, she somehow found out about the case. This is actually striking a memory of a different case where a child, like a son, goes missing. Mm-hmm. And he comes back several years later and like they're getting reacquainted with him because he was like pretty young. And I think he came back as like early teenager. And slowly they began to realize it's not the same person.
Yeah.
It was a different kid. I remember that case. It's almost identical. And in his case, he, I think, just wanted a family. And so you have to wonder in this scenario, was she just so desperate to have a family that wasn't her own?
Right.
This was like a way, you know, there's not a lot of logic here. It's more of like, I need an emotional thing and I can, you know.
She saw it and she was like, oh, we look alike.
Yeah.
Maybe I can pull this off. And yeah, it's been 38 years since Lucinda Hewells was last seen. And the really sad thing is that Larry Hewells, her husband, died in 2010 and never knowing what happened. And so her son has been carrying on talking about his mother's disappearance. And there are a lot of great links and stuff. That the last time she was seen, Lucinda Hewells, she's 5'6". Weighed 145 pounds as of her last sighting. She had medium length brown hair and brown eyes, and she's Caucasian and Hispanic. And so it's just definitely, I have a lot of great links to this. And again, thank you to Mile High Mystery on Reddit for providing a great layout of it. I just found that the whole element of the callback or the call out of nowhere, you know, and the impersonation element, and just the fact that she just, again, this is, we see so many of these stories where people go to a bar and they never are seen again.
Yeah.
They go out with friends and are never seen again. And there was really nobody who said, oh yeah, this guy looks suspicious. She just was gone.
Yeah.
And still gone to this very day.
Yeah. And you know, you just have to think, like, to your point, bars, there's a lot of stuff going on. People are, you know, their attentions are very narrow. They're drinking, they're with their friends. Mm-hmm. You know, you're over playing pool, you're over at the bar, you're sitting at the table.
Right.
That something can happen and you not even realize it's happened until it's, you know, too late. And it could be just one of those scenarios where the right thing happened at the right time and nobody was witness to it. I mean, finding her purse, it kind of makes me suspect foul play. But the fact that her money wasn't taken is the part that kind of throws me off a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. That they didn't at least take that. It was almost like whoever took that purse and dumped that purse, their goal was to do something to her. They didn't care about the money. And being in Tampa and being adjacent to water and, You know, I mean, it is one of those tragedies that I mean, it could still be solved, but it is, you know, one of those things that's happened long enough ago. And a lot of the people who were involved at the time are no longer around. But I will say this too, ladies, if you're going out to the bars together, you know, leave together. I mean, I definitely wouldn't blame the friends, but at this, because I've been in that situation, or I have left, or people have left me, and it's been fine. But, you know, in retrospect, I sometimes feel like be a unit, be a total unit together, coming and going.
And I would say for guys as well, because there's one of the latest batches of Unsolved Mysteries on Netflix is about guys who went to this. I think it's like a college. No, it's probably a high school party.
Yeah,
out somewhere, and they left one of their friends, and that friend
wound
up dead, and they don't know what happened to him to this day. And so, you know, leaving friends behind is we get why it happens, but it is it can be a very dicey proposition. You just don't know. So
for sure.
By the way, I tried to look up. I only found one podcast on Spotify about Lucinda Hules. So there's not a lot of coverage out there.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, I think this is definitely a case that has some potential other rabbit holes to go down if anybody is interested in the more investigative work. So yeah, I'm glad we were able to bring a little more attention to it. But now it is Chris's turn.
Okay, so now we're going to travel a little bit north out of the southeast up to Baltimore, Maryland.
Yes.
For number 8. Hello, Baltimore.
How's it going out there? It's a very, very infamous little town in some ways.
Not too far from D.C. and hustle and bustle of the nation's capital.
Yeah.
It's got a lot of its interesting stories. In fact, a runner-up that I didn't want to do, just because I talk about this case a lot, not necessarily on the podcast, but is Ray Rivera.
Oh, yes.
In the Belvedere Hotel.
Absolutely.
But you can find a great summary of that case on the new season of Netflix.
Yes.
Speaking of. I think it's the very first episode of the first season that came back.
Right.
Mystery on a Rooftop. Very haunting case. Also very much like all of these strange clues that don't quite add up and you don't know what to make of them all. And they're more puzzling than they are providing clues or answers.
Right, right.
So don't want to talk too much about that one, but that is a very chilling and fairly recent mystery.
Yeah.
I'm going to go a little bit deeper into Baltimore history for mine.
Ooh.
I'm going to talk about the man himself.
Oh.
The death of Edgar Allan Poe.
Oh, my God, this is like Christmas. That's a great, this is a great one.
So we have the mystery of Edgar Allan Poe's death, the mystery of who is Reynolds, and who is the unknown toaster.
What? Okay, well.
Three mysteries in one, everybody. So I'll be honest, I didn't know a lot about Poe's death. Mm-hmm. I had heard a lot of things about it. But nothing really ever stuck in my brain. The only thing ever stuck in my brain is that people said he was buried alive, which is not true. But he did very much die under mysterious circumstances on October 3rd in 1849. It was election day in Baltimore, as a matter of fact.
Oh, yes.
And apparently back in the day, a lot of people voted in like taverns.
Yeah.
And bars, which is just so funny to think about.
That's a great idea. That would increase turnout, I think.
Right. When a ragged man, barely conscious, lying in the gutter, is delirious, sputtering nonsense, looks like a hobo. He's wearing clothes far too large for himself, and he's taken to a local doctor. And there, it's shocking that they identify, this is the popular writer, Edgar Allan Poe.
Yeah, he was quite penniless at that point in his life, if I recall.
Yeah, what on earth happened?
Yeah.
And so he's looked over for the next few days, you know. Day two or so, he kind of starts to get a little bit better and things look promising. But then day three, he takes a mysterious turn.
Yeah.
He couldn't explain anything about how he had gotten to where he was. He was in and out of consciousness. There was hallucinations, confusion, incoherence. And so 4 days later, October 7th, he dies of what is called congestion of the brain.
Wow.
Yeah, so he stumbles into this bar October 3rd, October 7th, he's dead. But we don't exactly know what the cause was, you know, so it was there's all those like interesting things that you can put on like a broken heart. Not like a broken heart, but like there's really interesting things on causes of death on death
certificate. Oh, sure. Yeah.
Particularly old-timey ones where you're like, oh, you can die of that?
The vapors?
An unfit mind. Or, you know, stuff like that where you're like, oh, okay, the vapors. Consumption, you know, old-timey sounding things. So to this day, no one can really agree how or why he died. It's a real mystery and certainly worthy of an Edgar Allan Poe story itself.
For sure.
Especially because he's largely seen as the creator of the detective fiction genre with the story The Murders in the Rue Morgue. You know, this is before Sherlock Holmes. This is before Hercule Poirot. That's Agatha Christie's main detective. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. I had not realized that. He was sort of the founder.
I think he inspired Arthur Conan Doyle in some ways.
Sense. Yeah. That would make sense. It could be drug or alcohol overdose. He was certainly an alcoholic, though there are some questions on how much he was indulging at this time in his life. There's thought that he was assaulted, that it was a murder, that he was poisoned, he had an undiagnosed illness, or even he was a victim of cooping. Are you familiar with cooping?
Is that when you're like hanging out in a chicken coop or something? I don't know. Like,
is it hanging with Mr. Cooper in the 1990s? Okay, this is fascinating. It's a practice of drugging people and disguising them in order to force them to vote for a specific candidate over and over.
Dear God. Wow.
That's a thing apparently that was done back then.
Man, and they talk about voter fraud now. That is like, nobody's doing anything like that.
Someone's literally coming in a different outfit and a mustache and sunglasses. And it's like,
oh my God. You know, when you're mentioning all this, it kind of reminds me when we talked about the artist Caravaggio on our Haunted Paintings episode back in season 1, because there were multiple reasons or ways he could have died as well. Mm-hmm. Was he poisoned? Was he sick? He had a lot of enemies. There were a lot of people who might have wanted to kill him. But yeah, that's crazy.
That's a fantastic callback because it has a lot of the same hallmarks. Mm-hmm. And obviously both of them were very just tragic individuals in and of themselves. They had their own demons for sure.
Very much.
He got into brawls all the time.
Yes.
He was a fisticuffer.
And he killed someone. Right. Yeah. I don't know if Mr. Poe killed anyone, but, you know, somebody.
Only in his works.
Yes, that's true. That's true. He kept it to the page.
That's right. But this cooping explanation could be why he was in a strange outfit that did not fit
him. That makes a lot of sense.
I think he had like a straw hat on even.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
There's even thoughts of his tuberculosis, heart disease, epilepsy, diabetes. Who's to say?
Right.
And one of the few potential clues that we do have about his demise is he kept muttering Reynolds over and over.
Hmm.
And he had even visited a doctor over a week prior to his death to be treated for a fever.
Yeah.
So what's going on here?
That is interesting. And then Ryan Reynolds. It wasn't Ryan Reynolds. It
wasn't Ryan Reynolds.
Yeah.
It wasn't Sir Reynold Rapp.
Yes. Reynolds foil and nobody.
The aluminum magnate.
No, because then he would have been wrapped up in tinfoil and plastic.
Yeah, he would have been tinfoiled alive. So, there's a lot of speculation. Well, who was this Reynolds? Could it have been Jeremiah Reynolds, a writer?
What?
Whom Poe had a professional relationship with. But that seemed to be an unlikely candidate for a deathbed plea. Maybe it was Baltimore Judge Henry Reynolds.
Mm.
Maybe, you know, somehow got ensnarled with political crooks connected to the judge. It's a long shot, though. And we don't even have evidence that he was saying Reynolds. And who even knows if you're in out of consciousness, what that could even mean.
Right.
So that's a clue? Question mark? We just don't really know.
Right.
And then, of course, was Reynolds an unidentified assassin, a local ruffian who robbed Poe of his cash, issued his fatal beating, or maybe a random thought permeating from his delirious brain.
Twas the ruffian.
Fogged by impending death. Who is to say? Quoth Poe, nevermore.
I love it.
So some have even speculated that Poe didn't even mention the name, and it was just merely a recording mistake, as mentioned.
Yeah.
So who knows? But perhaps the most intriguing theory is Poe may have died from rabies.
Oh, I mean, that can make some sense given his manner and his, like, because I know, like, you end up in a sense of with a sense of delirium mm-hmm. or in delirium. Wow. And you know, if you're disoriented, you could be putting on clothes and doing all kinds of crazy crap, you know?
Also, you have a scenario where when he's in the hospital, he doesn't really seem to want to drink water.
Yeah.
Oh. And rabies was
hydrophobia.
Hydrophobia. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So there's some thought there. It lines up with some of his behavior. Apparently, when you have rabies, you can seem to be getting better before you take a turn for the worse, which right. he did when he was in the hospital.
Right.
In fact, this was interesting. At a clinical pathology conference in 1996, doctors were presented with a hypothetical patient and a list of symptoms that matched Poe's. When asked to offer a diagnosis, encephalitic rabies was a classic fit.
Wow.
There's even evidence Poe's doctor changed his cause of death as an object lesson on the dangers of drinking, as he was known for his drunken bouts. They were very well documented or just known at the time. And apparently this doctor, this physician, went on to later practice the temperance movement.
Oh, geez.
Which is effectively, if you don't know, advocate either moderation or often just abstinence from, you know, alcohol and other, you know, bad things.
The good time juice.
The good time juice. So.
Well, you know, that is very, very interesting and plenty of opportunity to get rabies. Now, people don't know that if there's even a bat in your house, you know, the animal bat, that you really ought to consider getting the vaccine series, because even a scratch from an infected animal can transmit the virus, and it is about 99.99% fatal.
Yeah.
Very few people have ever survived rabies once they start showing symptoms.
I believe it's single digit numbers yeah. of people.
Right.
In recorded history who have recovered.
It is probably the most fatal virus you can contract. So don't mess around with that.
Again, these are all still theories. Nothing is certain. But what is certain is that there's a mysterious figure who has been visiting Poe's gravesite, as far as we can tell, as early as the 1930s. And according wow. to witnesses, continued annually until 2009.
What?
And each year, in the morning of January 19th, which is Poe's birthday, a black-clad figure carrying a silver-tipped cane, a face obscured by a scarf or hood, would enter the Westminster Hall and Burying Ground in Baltimore and would go to the commemorative stone for Edgar Allan Poe and pour a glass of Martell cognac and raise a toast, becoming known as the Poe Toaster.
Okay, well, you know, now I can stop imagining an actual toaster.
Okay.
having anything
this
to
is
do
a maximum it. Overdrive yeah. we're not back to that. He would then arrange three red roses on the monument in a distinctive configuration and depart, leaving the unfinished bottle of cognac.
Interesting.
The roses were believed to represent Poe, his wife Virginia, and his mother-in-law Maria, all three of whom were originally interred at the site. The significance of the cognac is uncertain, as it does not feature in Poe's works like Amontillado.
Yeah
So It's kind of a mystery, but this has been an ongoing tradition again till at least about 2009, and even I think some mysterious notes were being left in like poem form.
This is so Poe.
Very, very interesting. But as far as I know, they've never really been able to identify who these Poe toasters are, and there's even been I'm calling them imposters.
Imposters, I love it.
There's even been imposters going in. Mimicking the tradition, but not getting all of the specificity correct. And apparently right. the person who I think works at the site, at the church, knows if it's the authentic Poe toaster or not. There's some kind of signal that only they know.
It's almost like some weird secret society or something.
Effectively, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like also a mascot. You'll never see someone walking around with a mascot outfit. Right. They will always disappear and come back.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
you know
yeah.
what I mean? So who's to say yet another mystery in the long line of, again, a story fit for Mr. Poe himself.
Yeah, yeah.
The rabies thing seems pretty strong, especially when you have those people who are not given the details.
Yeah.
All they're given are the symptoms. And they're giving effectively what a med student or a doctor would get.
Right.
Here's a patient. Here are the symptoms. What's going on?
Yeah.
And the fact that they... absent of knowing who this person was they right. were able to apparently consistently enough come up with rabies
right.
is telling.
Oh, if only they could have, I don't know, now there's probably been far too much time passed, but, you know, if there's some way you could exhume a body and find, maybe do some tissue analysis, if there would, there wouldn't be any tissue probably at all at this point, to find some evidence, you know, if that had been possible, say, even back in the 30s, 40s, or 50s. Because, I mean, when was it that he died? What year was that?
1849.
Oh, okay. So he has to go back a good bit further even. But damn, I mean, yeah, I knew that his death was mysterious, but I didn't know all the details surrounding it or the possible theory that it might have been rabies. And now when I hear about that, although that cooping thing is very interesting.
It's a very alluring thought. And it's definitely, you know, we're going to talk about that in some of these cases where sometimes the thing that seems fantastical is very, when nothing else seems to line up, that theory seems to be like, maybe the bizarre is actually not so bizarre after
all. Right.
Right. Yeah.
I love it. If anybody knows anything about what happened to Edgar Allan Poe, please reach out.
If you know who Reynolds was, if you're a descendant of Reynolds.
If you're Ryan Reynolds.
If you're Ryan Reynolds.
Please reach out to Ding Dong Darkness Time.
Call us on Mint Mobile.
Bring some aviation gin.
Yeah, I was going to say, we'll rewrite the Wikipedia article so the toaster brings aviation gin.
I love it.
It's too good. Okay. Well, we're... now going to go to the other coast. We've spent a lot of time on the East Coast.
That's right. That's right.
We get with so much more of the U.S. to explore. We cannot find any weirder a destination.
Something that they embrace it, probably.
Then the embracement, is that a word? It is now, right?
It is now. We're making
the embracement of weird by one, Portland, Oregon.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. In fact,
the town now known as Portland.
There is, in fact, in today's news, as of this recording in early January, somebody who was arrested for eating off half the face of a person at a bus station. So,
Excuse me?
Portland is pretty cray cray.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the bath salts are coming back. I think that's a... You know,
for eating a face, that would definitely be bath salts territory.
Yeah. Or unless it's like we're really in Shaun of the Dead now and things are starting to,
good gravy,
you know, pick up 28 days later, maybe. I don't know, but beware.
It's like Oregon saw the Florida Man stuff and was like, man, this is free publicity. We need our own version.
We need Florida Man of the Pacific Northwest.
Portland, let's get even weirder.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I thought I would take it a little more lighthearted.
Okay.
Because it's Portland.
Of course. Of course.
It is a place that embraces weird in only a way that Fred Armisen can capture in Portlandia.
Yes.
And Carrie, I always forget her last name, but she's hilarious in that.
Oh, she's great.
Yeah.
I love her.
Sorry, Carrie. I don't remember your last name. But, you know, the great show. You know, some of that does not feel like much of a stretch for Portland.
No, not at all.
So why not talk about the world famous Woodstock Mystery Hole?
What? Okay.
Trademark.
So my husband was born in Portland, right, and lived there most of his life until he met me, or went in the Navy and then met me. And then, you know, we lived out in the Pacific Northwest and we have a lot of family in Oregon. And I got to say, that's a new one for me. I thought I knew some good mysteries out there. The Mystery Hole.
The Mystery Hole.
Okay. Okay.
As summarized on Atlas Obscura.
Oh, perfect.
Beyond being incredibly fun, not much can be said about the hole with certitude. Prepare for the zany, everybody. Owned and operated by the Universal Church O Fund and championed by its jovial pastor, Baron Mind, leader of the Tunnel People, the Woodstock Mystery Hole stands as a monument to the irrefutable mores adhered to by the church's followers, included, but not limited to, have fun, make fun, be fun.
So wait, hold on. It's the church of having fun?
Church O Fun. The Universal Church O Fun.
The Universal Church O Fun.
O Fun.
I think I need to join this church. That sounds fun.
There are other mottos. The more you dig, the more tunnel you find. And eat, fuck, tunnel. So there you go.
Wow. See, that sounds like a much better book than Eat, Pray, Love.
Eat, fuck, tunnel. Well, you know, maybe it's bestseller in 2023.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Oh, my God.
So no one is entirely certain of how the mystery hole came to be, though the majority of experts and theorists agree it was not formed by natural forces.
Of course.
Adding to the hole's mystery is its uncertain depths, though the general consensus is it's very deep. Before venturing into the mystery hole, all pilgrims must complete a waiver reading, I, the undersigned, do hereby certify that I must be out of my mind to climb down into a damp, dark hole when I'm perfectly safe where I am.
I mean, if we had to sign a disclaimer for everything, thing we did. But
so Portlander Baron is known for bringing a lot of fun to the table, whether it's the mystery hole or by hosting a meteor catching party in his backyard in the summertime.
Meteor catching? Wow.
He's been a substitute teacher for over 40 years, which he says gives him a lot of free time to create fun experiences. It sounds like he'd be the best substitute teacher ever.
Oh, I never had a substitute teacher like that.
No, they're always so mean.
Yeah.
But to have this guy would be a treat.
Yeah.
To make fun where once there was none. Is a noble act of love, a generous gift of the most sacred of experiences, Baron writes in The Way of Fun. The mystery hole is, simply put, a hole in the ground with an attached ladder that takes you into a couple of subterranean tunnels where strange wonders can be found. If you knew what it was, though, it would hardly be a mystery. So according to the website, evidence of a vanished civilization has long been suspected to exist under the thick layer of earth laid down at the close of the last ice age. Known as the Brett's Floods, numerous colossal tidal waves of melted glaciers swept over eastern Washington and down the Columbia River Gorge, ponding over the Portland area and depositing silt before flowing out to sea. Sand, gravel, and finally clay covered all that had been created before 10,000 years ago. Leaving no physical trace of existence for future generations of inhabitants. No one would have suspected from looking at an ordinary wild blackberry patch in the subterranean backyard that Oregon's most incredible archaeological site lay waiting beneath.
Okay. All right. I gotta ask. Okay. How serious is this? Like, is this hole really a natural hole?
This might be part of the mystery, Allison.
Oh my God.
Because once inside, visitors can expect to experience such attractions as giant double arch, the gaping tunnel, and enchanting vapors of encouragement.
Okay.
All right. All not right. to mention the door that's never been opened.
What?
But don't worry. Each feature is trademarked in case you were doubting their validity or authenticity.
Is this a cult? Do I need to cover the Churcho Fund?
I don't think so.
On my Churcho Haven Fund.
I mean, you may be wondering what carved the hole. Was it ancient peoples?
Yeah.
So evidenced by the lack of pick and shovel marks on the walls. This is no recent dig. When asked how deep the hole goes, Baron confidently exclaims, "It goes all the way to the bottom." He's also quite certain if you remove more dirt, he'll find more hole.
This all feels like a joke, like one of those obvious jokes, like, why do firemen wear suspenders to hold their pants up?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, and for this, he warns amateur diggers, if you dig your own holes, you might soon be in over your head.
That is wise. Bear in mind.
Bear in mind. and why it was made, we can only speculate. Maybe it was a shelter or a ceremonial kiva. Maybe it was an outpost for an alien. Perhaps just a wine cellar, fallout shelter, or a septic tank. Or it could just be a hole. But for those who wish to stay topside, are not without their own mysteries to encounter, including the mystery tower, the hedge maze, the mystery pole, mirror of higher truth, and Molokai, the history mole of the mystery hole. He's said to be a good omen and spirit animal for intrepid diggers the world over. Or perhaps you'd like to board the small boat outside. Baron said it will take passengers anywhere they please, so long as they are dreaming. He calls it the dream boat.
Oh my God.
Visitors could also take a piece of the mystery home with them.
Okay.
Including a creative mystery air, guaranteed bottled from the depths below, or a postcard of the hole that's all black, available both in horizontal and vertical.
I can't. This is probably the best Atlas Obscura I've heard of.
So is this place another fading slice of Americana, a roadside attraction with a special twist? Or is it a true wonder masquerading as such? Sadly, we may never know, as the greatest mystery of all is its permanent closure.
Are you kidding me? Listen, the hole still has to be there. You just gotta, like, go to the hole.
Well, unfortunately, you're not given the exact location until you contact Baron Mine, and he gives you a time to give you a tour.
See, but he just gives that...
The attraction is sadly closed.
Yeah.
So until the depths can be plumbed once again, the mystery hole will remain an enigma that rightly helps Portland stay a little bit weirder.
Yeah.
And hopefully the mystery of the hole will fill each of us with more joy and fun than we had before. Because even though the hole may be shallow in answers, the depths of its dad jokes remain bottomless.
You know, I feel like we needed that.
It was a fun little palate cleanser. I kept trying to find more information about this mystery hole. It just sounds like a guy who just has
a
wonderful sense of, like, wonder and joy and enthusiasm that's infectious. And I'm like, my Lord, don't we need more of that in the world?
I completely agree. Yeah. I love a dad joke probably more than anything else. Yeah. And I love the quirkiness of it is perfectly befitting that town.
Oh yeah.
But I love that when it reminds me of something, a lot of the things that my husband and I encountered on our Route 66 journey, because there is a lot of little weird kitschy things like that. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, you have the giant neon soda bottle and, you know, and all these things. And then, and we stopped at the Uranus fudge factory in Missouri, and they just embrace all the toilet humor in the world. Every bit as much as something like that. And it's just sad that it's closed, but. Now I just really want to learn more about this church.
Well, you can go check it out. There's a lot of fun stuff online to learn more about the mystery hole.
Yes.
The deluxe mystery hole of Woodstock, a little neighborhood of Portland, Oregon. Thank you, Portland.
Yes. Thank you very much.
I did want to give a little shout out because it's gotten some more exposure recently, particularly in podcasts. There is an unsolved disappearance of a young man in the Portland area. Okay. Kyron Horman, which you're also very familiar with.
Yes.
And Kyron was had just turned 7 years old. It was in 2010, and he was missing during a school science fair, as a matter of fact.
Yes.
And there was a massive search effort to find him over a week and a half, involved over 1,000 people, and actually stretched from Oregon to Washington and even into Northern California. Nothing's really ever been found about him, despite having national attention. But there's all this kind of family, personal stuff that you could really go down a rabbit hole.
Mm-hmm.
Restraining orders, divorce filings.
Possible hitman being hired.
Possible hit people and just a lot of randomness that is probably getting in the way more than anything else.
Yeah.
The Prosecutor's Podcast recently did a 3-part series, episodes 163 to 165, which are, I think, probably some of the best coverage you're going to find about Kyron's case. So if you're in the Portland area and want to learn more about this case and, you know, maybe decide you have something to kind of help, or who knows, you know something or whatever, you know, I know the family's still looking for answers.
I absolutely feel like this is one that hinges on a witness sighting or something like that, because it's kind of maddening. It's one of those, it's like an itch you just can't quite reach.
Yeah.
There are a lot of suspicious things around this that just you need, as Brett and Alice said on the Prosecutors, it's just like one more thing mm-hmm. would have been enough.
Mm-hmm.
And we just don't have that one more thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, time has passed, but, you know, we're seeing cases every day being solved that are old, you know, and cold cases. So, that case was hot and heavy when I was living out there, and it was consuming the media and it got a lot of coverage, and I'm just heartbroken it hasn't been solved. So, all right. Now you took us out to the coast.
Yep.
To the left coast. And now we're heading back.
We're going to stop in the middle.
Yep.
we're going to give a little shout out to Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Love me some Minneapolis. Mm-hmm. Good times. It's a fun town.
And I think if you drove from Portland to Minneapolis, you'd probably pass Waldrug. Speaking of a little slice of Americana.
Absolutely.
Take a 90 out. So let's take, we'll rein in this episode. Mm-hmm. Take a little look here. We're going to talk specifically about St. Paul, which they're kind of nestled together. It's the twin city.
Yeah.
So
yeah, it's the less fun twin. I'll just say I had a stop in St. Paul on my book tour and it was not a good time, but I'm sure it was better. You know,
you just looked overall out the window longingly at Minnesota and you were like, if only.
Listen, I could have very nearly been a true crime case out in St. Paul. I'll just say that much. I was standing outside my hotel getting ready to head back to the airport. I had a Uber on the way and this guy pulls up to me and tries to pretend that he's an Uber driver. He's like, you ready to go to the airport? Because I was standing outside with my phone in my hand and my suitcase looking very much like a tourist.
Oh, yeah.
So I was like, no, you're not my Uber driver. And he's like, are you sure? And yeah, this whole back and forth. And finally, I went back inside and had to let security know there's. Yeah. So be careful out there.
Listen, I got into a pirate cab in Costa Rica.
So, yeah. Oh,
man. Which we only learned about halfway through the ride when my friend turned around to me and said in English, we're not in a real cab.
Oh, and we are both here having this conversation. Ooh. It just tells you how lucky we have been.
Live to tell the tale, goodness. Okay. Right. Mm. So I want to talk about Minnesota's oldest murder mystery.
Ooh, okay.
A mystery that predates the state of Minnesota, as a matter of fact.
Wow.
Yeah, we're going back to the territories, y'all.
Yes.
We're going back to Fort Snelling of 1838.
Okay.
I want to talk about Edward Phelan, who was a soldier stationed at the fort.
Mm-hmm.
And he had come west with the army, was about to be discharged after 3 years of service. Edward had a little bit of a reputation.
Yeah.
Bit of a hothead. Bit of a bully. Kind of a joik.
He was like a Biff character.
Don't be a Biff. Come on, everybody.
Don't ever be a Biff.
What are you looking at, butthead? You can say stuff like that. About as dumb as a screen door in a battleship.
Why don't you make like a tree and get out of here?
It's lead, you fool. Make like a tree and lead. And suddenly we became a podcast about other things. Yeah. Oh, goodness. So as I mentioned, this is a critical time in Minnesota's history because we are not yet at statehood. We're about 20 years, in fact, before Minnesota statehood. And Phelan was kind of this, well, wrong man in the right place, I guess you could say. Because recently a treaty was signed about a year before with the Ojibwe people and the U.S., which made it legal for settlers to claim land between the Mississippi and Wisconsin rivers. Mm-hmm. And soldiers who got discharged from Fort Snelling had an early crack at some top land because they were right there. And Phelan, he kind of had a, you know, problem. He's from New York. He was probably from the streets, maybe involved with some gangs. So, you know, he's like, ooh, I could be a big land claimer. Like, this is a cool idea. Problem, though, he ain't got no money.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that'll stop you.
Yeah. Kind of need to have a little money to claim that land. So he teams up with the sergeant at the fort, John Hayes. Hayes had the money, but wasn't due to be discharged for another year. But at that point, the best claims are going to be gone. So it's one of those like, wait a second, I'm available and can get us land now.
Oh, interesting.
So when you're out of the army next year,
yeah,
it'll be there for you. You'll still have the choice land.
Right.
A little bit of a long con on Mr. Phelan's part.
Right.
Neither could get the land without the other. And so really kind of an odd couple scenario where Phelan was uneducated, crude, and had this criminal past. Hayes was affable. He supposedly got along with everybody. He just seemed like an all-around, you know, good guy. So the deal was struck that Phelan would claim the two tracts of land, which is basically in like downtown St. Paul, like modern day.
Okay.
And he'd built a cabin at, I guess, what is now the Xcel Energy Center, at least when this article was written. I know these things change sponsorship right. a lot. It might be called something different, but I'm sure if you live there, you know what I'm talking about. So the next year, Hayes is discharged and he joins Phelan at the cabin. And apparently neighbors are like, there's a lot of fighting going on over there. Near constant.
Oh, wow.
Kind of from the get-go. And then September of 1839, Hayes isn't seen anymore.
Oh, that's interesting.
Okay. But his body turns up 3 weeks later, badly beaten, near Carver's Cave in St. Paul.
Hmm.
And Phelan, of course, is an early suspect.
Yeah, naturally.
So Henry Sibley, who went on to be the first governor of Minnesota once it got its statehood, he's investigating the case as the Justice of Peace. And within a couple of weeks, Phelan is arrested. He's actually tried for murder, but was not convicted.
Ah.
And by the time historians were wanting to research the case, this is as early as 1870s. So again, not much, what, some 30 years later, court documents seem to have vanished.
Okay. Oh, convenient.
Yeah, there was a person, Fletcher Williams. He's going to be the first secretary of Minnesota. He was doing research as early as the 1870s and couldn't find the documents. So this left like a big dark hole of what actually happened. Why was he not convicted?
Right.
You know, was there missing evidence or, you know, misleading the jury or just, you know, like a better case from the defense or, you know, who knows?
Right.
So it's not super clear. But what ends up happening is there are papers from someone, Joseph R. Brown, one of the state's founding fathers. And there's a court ledger found there. And so this really helps fill in some of those gaps because meticulous notes had been taken. And so using these notes, the author of this book I'm going to talk about, he could fill in some of the details on this 150-year-old murder. So it's really being able to go back and unearth this little like treasure trove, if you will.
Yeah.
So the ledger includes a testimony of 12 witnesses, two separate but conflicting accounts from Phelan himself. And Brueggemann, this author, he goes on to write a book in 2012 where he attempts to lay out what really happens.
Mm-hmm.
And so what this ledger kind of shows is that Hayes went missing. Phelan was the one who raised the alarm. So he's the one to like, oh, my partner didn't show up. I don't know what's happening. So he's definitely going to be the person to kind of take the, if I report it, you know, the spotlight's not on me, right?
Which is kind of the opposite, you know, in general. Like sometimes the people who report are the ones that are looked at first, yeah.
So he says that he thinks Hayes had gone off to look for some missing cattle that were stolen by Native Americans. Of course, let's blame them.
Yeah.
A search party was formed, even though the story doesn't really hold up. They crossed the river, but some of the people who were there, like, there's no footprints where a canoe would have landed. This seems a little suspect. And then, like, 3 weeks after that, a group of Native Americans are visiting the fort, and they tell the soldiers that there was a body near a place that's called Dayton's Bluff.
Oh.
And it says a military doctor and soldiers went to investigate. Phelan was already there when they arrived. Apparently, Hayes' head was bashed in. His jaw was broken. It was a brutal. And apparently when he was tried, Phelan, you know, was really being frank and in ways that were kind of self-incriminatory. And I think he said something like, if your partner disappears and you're totally innocent, why would you lie? But he was, again, found not guilty. I couldn't find exactly why.
Yeah, he's just very slippery. He's a little Teflon dude here. Yeah.
And he went back to the land, the tracts of land that they had gotten. Mm-hmm. Although apparently another settler had claim jumped Hayes' tract of land because he had died.
Yeah.
But Phelan, you know, was froze out by his neighbors. They didn't trust him. They basically more or less kind of run him out of town. And he ends up, you know, resettling somewhere else, becomes a cattle farmer. And in 1848, he becomes one of the delegates of the Stillwater Convention that puts Minnesota on the path to statehood.
What? Wow. Wow.
But despite that, he couldn't escape the specter of guilt.
Yeah.
You know, there's some story of a Dakota tribesman who confessed on his deathbed to Hayes's murder, but this is a somewhat of a suspicious confession that's, it's all secondhand at best.
And there was so much fighting going on at the homestead. It just sounds like, you know.
And then Phelan dies in 1850 under mysterious circumstances.
Oh, rabies?
could be rabies. So, it's just, it's a crazy case.
I mean, you're talking about like, I mean, this is at the basis of the founding of an entire state in a lot of ways in terms of, you know, where he ended up. This guy is, listen, I mean, he sounds like a killer. I mean,
well, listen to his death. So he flees to California, to escape perjury charges. Mm-hmm. On his journey, he's killed by his traveling companions in what they claim is self-defense. So he just seems like he's got a little bit of a killer streak in him.
I would agree with that. Absolutely.
But that's kind of what we know. And here's the crazy thing. And if you're from or lived in the St. Paul, Minneapolis area, you know there's a lot of things named after Phelan.
Yeah.
In that town.
Wow.
Even though like this happened as early as the late 1800s. And even back then, residents took issue with it. And they were like, it's a disgrace. And yet nothing is named after Hayes.
Right. And he was the one who was murdered.
Yeah. And it was like, by all accounts, you know, a reputable soldier, and, right, you know, who served in the area and whatnot. And
yeah,
yet there's nothing named after him.
Well, it is kind of like, as they say, like, you know, history being written by the winners, even if maybe the winner is a murderer. Yeah. I mean, clearly he went on to, you know, Phelan went on to build influence. And was able to, in some ways, I guess, linger in the memories of people longer, even if it wasn't always in the best way. So what? No publicity is bad publicity, or whatever that term is. So he just stayed in the memory long enough. So it's just one of those things where people, maybe they thought to name something after somebody without really digging into their background, you know?
I mean, and while the court records are gone. We've had statues of Columbus and some other folks.
Yeah.
And,
you know, another
only
instance
now really
of that.
Being contested. So, there's probably a lot of bastards that were, you know, naming stuff after. But the author says that he believes the bones of Hayes are buried below Dayton's Bluff, somewhere between Warner Road and the railroad tracks.
Yeah, yeah.
Don't go digging, folks. Don't do that. I'm sure this is land that you can't just go on your little amateur, you know, sleuth case on. But if you want to learn more about this, Gary Brueggemann, he wrote Minnesota's Oldest Murder Mystery, The Case of Edward Phelan, St. Paul's Unsaintly Pioneer.
Oh, I love it. I love me some historical true crime. Mm. And that one just... really, really fascinates me.
Well, and to your point about, I know it's a different time, but it's like, you know, this was a case lost to the ages until someone cracked open that set of documents and found the ledger. And that put two and two together and filled in some gaps. It doesn't solve anything, but it fills in details we didn't know that might get us one step closer.
And to be able to sort of anything to right the wrong, it's never too late. And that's another thing I like about the historical cases, too, is, you know, they give you a way to go like, OK, let's look closer at the people that we're dealing with now so that maybe we're not naming buildings after them or streets after them in, you know, 100 years. Because,
Well, I'm going to tell you this because you gave me a little teaser about your Dayton case.
Yeah.
If you think this one's crazy, wait till I tell you about my next case on the next episode.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Way to leave them hanging, Chris. I'm going to say, the next week has the top five. I'm really looking forward to because there are some cities in it that, again, are known to harbor weird and unusual and some of my favorite cities in the country. But this has been a great roundup so far. And if you're from any of the cities that we've mentioned today, you know, please reach out and let us know about any other mysteries or if you know anything about these particular mysteries. Would love additional insights, especially if you've been down in the hole of mystery. I really want to know what's down there. but definitely stick with us and pay attention for next week's episode so you can hear the top five, and it is not going to disappoint you. I promise.
I can't wait.
All right. Now, if you have any questions or concerns or what have you, ideas, reach out to me at ddarknesstime@gmail.com or on Facebook, same name, or on Twitter. You just find me at Ding Dong Darkness Time Podcast on Facebook. Talk to you guys next week in five more cities, five more mysteries. We'll see you later.
I can't wait.
No. Ding Dong Darkness Time has been brought to you and produced by yours truly, Allison Dixon. It was made possible by an array of amazing co-hosts, friends, family, but especially you, the listeners. Big shouts also go out to the brilliant Nathaniel Dixon for the show art and future legend Spencer Morlock for all the music. I'll be back again soon with another episode. In the meantime, be good, you little ding-dongs.